Hello, I'm Tony Jakubowski. This is number 0444, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0444. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Lupita Samuels, author of the Colorblind series of books.
I have been wanting to write those books for years ago, and they did not materialize until I retired. So it's been a project in my mind forever because this is an ongoing problem that I see not only across races or across cultures, but in our own communities among our own people.
Patrick C. Byrne is the author of Double Entendre, The Parallel Lives of Mae West and Ray Bourbon.
I was lucky enough to have met Ray Bourbon when he was in his Twilight career, and I became fascinated with Ray on stage. And he frequently would mention his association with Mae West. So one night, I had had enough to drink, and I had enough nerve to approach Ray, and I asked him if it was really true he knew Mae, and he said, yes, he did. Well, after that, I'd go back, and he'd come off stage after the show, and we'd have a drink, and he'd tell me just amazing stories about his association with Mae.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. Now that El Chapo is going on trial in Brooklyn, is Peter worried about him tunneling out of another jail?
I get people tours of Brooklyn, and he happens to be in the Brooklyn Federal Prison. So what I do when I drive by is I say, that's where the tunnel is going to start, and that's where the tunnel is going to end. The side story to that is that the judge has asked or said to this guy, will you promise not to kill the jurors? Which is, you know, a really strange thing, but he did. And El Chapo said, of course not, I won't have any of the jurors killed. How's that for something that's creepy?
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0444 was Tony Jakubowski, founder of Access International Incorporated, a customs brokerage firm. And thank you very much, Tony, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Authorities in Portugal say a man who arrived in the country from Brazil was found to be hiding 2.2 pounds of cocaine in a set of false butt cheeks. The Portuguese judicial police said the tax and customs authority stopped the 32-year-old man at Lisbon Airport when they determined he was under investigation by the National Anti-Narcotics Trafficking Unit. The man was searched and officers discovered he was wearing a false derriere filled with 2.2 pounds of cocaine. Police said a 40-year-old man who was suspected of being the intended recipient of the drugs was arrested at the train station in Lisbon. Both men were detained on drug trafficking charges. So, what we're saying here is he had a fake crack filled with real crack. I'll bet in prison he'll be the butt of many jokes. 28-year-old Naquan Wilson was arrested after his shift at the Garden City, New York post office, charged with stealing credit cards from the mail. According to prosecutors, he took at least 30 credit cards over a period of at least 8 months and would go on the dark web to purchase information about the people whose cards he'd stolen. Wilson is known as the sock man at the local mall because people notice he kept his money and credit cards in a sock. He also drew attention in the parking lot. He arrived in a Maserati. Authorities searched his home and found nearly $30,000 in cash, as well as handguns, designer shoes, and luxury handbags. He was held on $50,000 bail. Gee, do you think he might consider paying his bail with credit cards? What are the odds, huh? Houston realtor Nicole Lopez is sporting a new nickname these days, the Taco Lady. Since late 2017, Lopez has incorporated a novel incentive for buyers of homes she's listed, $250 in free tacos with the purchase of a home. Let's be honest, everyone in Texas loves tacos, Lopez said, and so it's really been this taco the town, she laughs. Ha 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 ha. That's a good one. I know someone who loves puns too. Yeah. Anyway, let's move on. Lopez cited as proof of her success a $170,000 home that's under contract, and they are super excited for their taco party at the end of the month. Well, you know, you have to come up with some kind of hook to sell these days. I mean, it is a dog-eat-dog world out there.
Yo quiero Taco Bell.
Yes. 48-year-old Jesse Dorsett of Sandy, Oregon, has three cats, Pixie, Dixie, and Jinx, named after the Hanna-Barbera cartoon characters. The cats enjoy riding on the hood of his car. Dorsett will drive at about 5 miles per hour on the edge of parking lots while one of the cats sits on the hood scanning the grass for prey. The cats are always on a leash and held as close as possible to the windshield. If it jumps off, he'll stop the car and either he or his wife will get out and take them for a short walk on the leash. Dorsett tried to explain this to a woman who took photos of Pixie on his hood, and then had to explain it to police who called asking if his cat was injured. Dorsett shot a short video of Pixie and sent it to the officer, and the matter was dropped. I don't think it's a good idea to be doing that, and it's certainly something we can't recommend, said a police spokesman, who added that there's no law against cats riding on moving vehicles, although there is one against dogs doing so. Well, now we know which species has a stronger lobby. And of course, we know which species is really in control. I mean, regular listeners to the show know that I've been trying to warn you for years. Cats are evil, little pieces of evil plotting against mankind. No one listens to me when I say this, but they will eventually find out that this is indeed true. Of course, by then, it will be too late. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Connecticut State Police say they finally got the scoop on the poop. State police arrested a 43-year-old woman in connection with human excrement deposited on three separate occasions in the middle of the same cul-de-sac in East Granby. Holly Malone was charged with misdemeanor breach of peace. She lives a few miles away from the cul-de-sac in Simsbury. Troopers say a motion-activated camera set up after the second incident in November recorded Malone's car. Authorities say Malone told them that she's lactose intolerant but sometimes eats dairy products, and she stopped in the cul-de-sac because she couldn't make it to a bathroom in time. State police say she's apologized. Okay, is anybody really buying her story? I mean, let's, for argument's sake, take her side of the story and take her at her word, okay? She has this little accident once, but what are the odds that she has to drop trow and expose her rear end on the same dead-end street on three separate occasions? And don't people who are lactose intolerant to that degree know that they should stay away from consuming dairy products? I mean, her explanation is, well, crappy. That's all I can say. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? The issue of skin color has plagued society for centuries. Nowadays, it is undeniable that the same issue persists. Lupita Samuels was born in Costa Rica. She worked as an educator in the New York City public school system for over 20 years. She's the author of the Colorblind book series, which includes her latest book, Think Folks Are Too Light? Think Again. Is White Too White? Lupita joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Lupita.
Hello. How are you, Peter? Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for being on the program with us. When did you first decide to start these series of books? Was there a moment when push came to shove and said, you had to do this?
I have been wanting to write those books for years ago. And they did not materialize until I retired. So it's been a project in my mind forever, because this is an ongoing problem that I see not only across races or across cultures, but in our own communities, among our own people.
Well, that's something I wanted to bring up, too, because you come from Costa Rica. My family originally is from Barbados. So it's places where you don't necessarily find that you are in the minority. You are usually in the majority. And when you are in the majority, for instance, in the West Indies, I know for a fact that where there are not many whites, there is still racism. And that is, it goes by shade.
Exactly. There is what I call a skin color hierarchy. It's like coffee, Peter. You like to say light coffee is better than regular coffee. Regular coffee is better than dark coffee. And dark coffee is better than black coffee. There's a skin hierarchy. So the lighter you are, the more acceptable you're becoming.
And I think also, by the way, that it rings true for those who are white. I have friends of mine who are European and in descent, and their parents have come from Europe, and they've expressed the same situation. Germans who were ostracized because their hair was darker or their eyes weren't blue. Same thing with other groups in Italy and Sweden. So people will find a difference where the difference is minimal.
Yeah, but I don't know, Peter, there seems to be a new trend among white people. For example, years ago, they would do skin whitening, because especially the women, because the lighter the women, the more marriageable or the more acceptable socially. But now, among the younger people, white kids between, let's say, 18 to about 35, there's a new trend, which is skin tanning. They are going to these tanning beds, artificial lights, exposing themselves to a lot of radiation, which is harmful to your skin in the long run. And it's a growing, booming business in the United States. If you look online, you will see how this business is booming in the United States.
And what goes around comes around. And the reason why I say that is I grew up in the 60s, and there weren't a lot of tanning beds then. But at that time, there were a lot of tanning reflectors. There was a lot of skin products that could help people make their skin darker. So there was a big boom on tanning back in the 60s when I was growing up as a kid. Why do you think it is that we tend to focus so much on the differences? Either we want to change ourselves, or we want to rate other people based on skin color or even hair type, for instance.
I also have a book. I'm glad you mentioned hair types, because my new book that just came out this summer is Hairmetology. And it's a grading system, a new grading system for hair types, because that's another issue also. But as getting back to your question, Peter, it seems to me like people are working towards social acceptation. People want to be loved and to be accepted. So whatever the media stereotypes as the color, the complexion, the look, people go through any means to achieve it, to get the look or look the look.
Your books, the Colorblind series and the latest one that you have out right now, when you started writing these books, who did you see as your prime audience? Were you looking at an audience of color? Were you looking at the white audience? Or were you trying to bring them both together?
I was looking at biodiversity. All the four books, Think Folks Are Too Black, Think Folks Are Too Dark, Think Folks Are Not Too, and Think Folks Are Too Light. What we try to do was incorporate human beings from all nations, all races, and all ages and all stages. Because this is not a problem per se only in people of color. It's a worldwide phenomenon, Peter. In India, these beautiful blonde people. The skin bleaching business is booming in Africa. I was just reading an article yesterday in South Africa. This great, this handsome young man is a rapper, and he's bleaching his skin with this product called Lemonvate, which contains mercury, and in the long run could give you what you call immunotoxicology, which means it could poison your immune system and lead to cancer. But they decide, I want to have the look. And even though they know the dangers, many people know the dangers, they're still using these products. In America, we have the bleaching creams and the hydroquinone in it that is also dangerous because it contains lead, which could also lead to cancer in the long run.
Do you think, I mean, since you say it's a global situation, do you think mankind's obsession with skin color, either being too dark or too light or anywhere in between, will ever fade away, pardon the pun, or is it something that mankind is going to have to live with as long as there's mankind?
You know what I'm thinking, Peter? That's why I'm writing my book. Maybe it won't fade completely, but my books, if received, could ameliorate the problem to some extent. Because we could unlearn these stupid myths. Because you know what, Peter? Look, most people do not care what color a pet is. We're receptive to biodiversity in mammals, in birds, in amphibians, in reptiles. We are so open and colorblind when it comes to animals. So why can't we transfer those same skills to the human kind, to our own kind?
That's a very good analogy, and I'll bring up another one. I'm a big fan of Star Trek, right? And I find that one of the things that brings humanity together is if there is a greater or different species to deal with. That we won't see each other as one group of people unless we have another group of people to either battle or war with. And so from that point of view, I don't think we're ever going to get rid of this issue per se. Now, you are someone who, as I mentioned, you were originally from Costa Rica.
I think we can, because it started with me.
Right.
I had my own complexes as a young girl. And I used to buy those little tubes and rub on my face trying to be lighter, too.
Mm-hmm.
But you know something? Once, in writing this book and doing the research, by the help of God, my eyes were open to see, wait a minute, I'm brown, and here's a brown puppy. So I'm part of the animal kingdom. This is biodiversity. And when I learned that concept, I was no longer, this desire to be lighter, I mean, totally left me. So if it can happen to me, it can happen to others. Because I overcame, and I believe others can overcome too.
As I was about to ask, you, as I say, you're originally from Costa Rica. You then went to teach for 20 years in the public school system in New York City. New York is certainly a melting pot of different cultures, and every different shade of human being I'm sure you came across in school as a teacher. Having lived both spectrums, living in a place where you were the majority and living in a place where it's like I said, a wide spectrum. You probably have a good analogy, a good take on the differences of how society treats people based on skin color because of the two worlds you were from.
Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Costa Rica, where I grew up, is pretty much, I've lived more years in this country than I live in my own, where
right.
I was born, because I came here at the age of 20. But Costa Rica really did not like Santo Domingo, unlike Cuba, Santo Domingo, Haiti. Costa Rica did not import slaves. What happened is that slaves became liberated. My ancestors were from Caribbean descent, Jamaican, to be precise. And once the British people released their slaves, a lot of them went to Panama, to Costa Rica, and these other countries, and that's where I came in. We were not like a majority in numbers. We were really like 6% of the population, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have that pressure because of we're living among people rather than us. We wanted to be like them.
It's a fascinating topic. It's a fascinating discussion on a series of books that I'm sure would be thought-provoking for anybody who picked up the series of books you have. The books are the Colorblind Book Series, written by Lupita Samuels. Lupita, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you. This was fun. And I hope to talk to you again, Peter.
Absolutely.
Okay, have a great day.
Lupita Samuels, author of the Colorblind Book Series, which includes her latest release, Think Folks Are Too Light, Think Again Is White Too White. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page number for this show, which is show number 0444, and you'll find links to Lupita's two sites, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Double Entendre of the Parallel Lives of Mae West and Ray Bourbon, plus Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, will share another slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. Stick around for that. We do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, did you hear the one about the guy who walks into a Winn-Dixie store to see if he won? It starts like this. The Winn-Dixie store employee in Fort Myers, Florida, says to the guy who handed her a lottery ticket, "You won $5." But the $5 she handed him, he noticed, came from her purse. The ticket's actual value was $600. And the man who presented it worked for the Florida Lottery Commission. The undercover agent arrested 42-year-old Crystal Yvette Batten. She lost her job and acquired a grand theft charge, and her bond is set at $5,000. Wow, that's a lot to lose on one lottery ticket, especially a ticket that wasn't yours in the first place. And you know, these days we hear too many reasons as to why a school might be in lockdown. You know, the recent shooting that took place in a school in Florida being one of the most extremely sad situations we've seen of late. But for a high school in southeast Idaho, it was an entirely different situation. That's because it was briefly placed on lockdown after a bull escaped an auction yard and stormed past the campus. The Black Angus bull rampaged across the town of Burley, trampling over signs and charging at people before arriving at Burley High School. Sheriff Jay Heward said the officers were not able to capture the bull, so the animal was killed in order to keep the public safe. He says no gunshots were fired on school grounds. The Cassia County Sheriff's Office notified school officials, who placed the campus on lockdown for about 15 minutes as officers followed the animal. Principal Levi Power says students had been dismissed for lunch, but staff were able to secure the school. You know, I think the obvious happy ending to this story now is if all the kids at the school are invited to, you know, one hell of a barbecue. Yeah. When it comes to criminals, there is a special place in hell for this next guy. Police have arrested a man they say broke into people's homes in Massachusetts while they attended wakes or funerals. Authorities say they began to suspect 35-year-old Randy Brunel during an investigation into a series of break-ins on Cape Cod. Brunel previously had served an 18-month prison sentence on a 2012 conviction for breaking into a police officer's home as the officer attended his mother's funeral. Barnstable police say they followed his car Friday while other officers went to homes of residents attending funerals. Officers discovered a break-in and pulled Brunel over. Police say they arrested him after finding jewelry in his pockets. Brunel, who police nicknamed the Obit Bandit, is facing multiple charges, including felony breaking and entering. You know, clearly, Randy didn't get enough hugs as a child. Either that, or he only watched the first half of The Grinch Who Stole Christmas and thought it was a documentary. Anyway, we have time for one more story in this section of Stuff File News. Before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 60-year-old Cheryl Merrill of Ponte Verde Beach, Florida, was arguing with her boyfriend of 5 years about who would win the Super Bowl. Apparently, she was trash-talking Tom Brady. The boyfriend didn't take too well to that and pushed her onto a bed, and she became so enraged shortly after kickoff that she picked up a wooden shelf and threw it at him. St. Johns County Sheriff's deputies were called and found Merrill extremely intoxicated. She disobeyed orders to remain in the cul-de-sac while deputies investigated the incident. She got into her car and started the engine, but deputies forcibly removed her from the vehicle. Merrill was charged with aggravated battery and taken to the St. Johns County Jail. Her boyfriend was unable to sign an affidavit because of the hand injury he sustained in the assault. You know, I wonder if they have any theories as to which athletes will be doing well during the Olympics. That could be a battle royale. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Patrick C. Byrne is the author of Double Entendre, The Parallel Lives of Mae West and Ray Bourbon. It chronicles the two larger-than-life entertainers whose careers each span 7 decades. Patrick joins us on the line right now from Kansas City. Hi, Patrick.
Hi there, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Your book, as the subtitle shares, it tells the parallel lives of Mae West and Ray Bourbon. I'm sure, even though they've been gone for a while now, there are a lot of people that still know Mae West and know of her life and her story, but maybe not so much Ray Bourbon. What made you decide to put these two together in this book?
Well, you know what they tell you in writing class, write about something you know. And I had previously written a book about Maria Callas, the Opera Diva. And I decided to write another book and kept in mind what my teachers at Rocker said. And I thought, what do I know a lot about? Well, I know a lot about female impersonators. And I was lucky enough to have met Ray Bourbon when he was in his twilight career in Kansas City's Jewel Box. And I was just a student at a beauty college. And I became fascinated with Ray on stage. He was a type of more of a stand-up comedian, not a lip syncer, not a hoochie-coochie dancer. And he was very clever and very topical. And he frequently would mention his association with Mae West. Well, I have always been a Mae West fan, even as a child. My father loved her. And so one night I had had enough to drink and I had enough nerve to approach Ray, and I asked him if it was really true he knew Mae, and he said yes, he did. Well, after that I'd go back and he'd come off stage after the show and we'd have a drink, and he'd tell me just amazing stories about his association with Mae.
How long ago were these stories being told to you?
Oh, in the very early 60s. I'm 75 years old, and Ray was almost in his dotage. In fact, he was arrested and died in jail not that long after I met him.
So when he started telling you these stories, then Mae West was also still alive as well.
Yes, oh, very much so. Mae kept kicking until, I think, 87. She made her last film when she was 86 years old. It was called Sextet. It's a little hard to watch, but it's campy enough. If you like that sort of thing, it's great fun.
I've actually seen parts of that movie, so I know the movie you're referring to. And when did Ray pass away?
Ray passed away at almost 71 years of age in a little town in Texas. He'd been incarcerated for falsely accused of murder. But, you know, Texas, the mindset, and here's an old drag queen sitting on the bench being accused of murder, and they put him in jail, and he died of medical neglect.
Now, you say falsely accused of murder. Has he ever been exonerated?
No. And like I said, it's Texas, so I hope you know, Texas listeners aren't offended, but especially in the early 60s, a drag queen was something that was not that generally accepted.
Who was
and
he?
Ray was very much out.
Who was he accused of murdering?
It's kind of a long story, but Ray was a hoarder of animals, dogs in particular, and he had a large number of them. And when he'd travel to another venue other than Kansas City to perform, he would take the dogs in a big trailer behind his station wagon. And unfortunately, it broke down in a little town in Texas, and he had to go on to fulfill his contract to perform. So he found a veterinarian who said he'd be willing to take the dogs and keep them till Ray came back through. And one thing led to another. There was a big delay, and Ray didn't contact the vet. The vet disposed of the dogs, and Ray became just enraged, and he told his boyfriend, who unfortunately was a street hustler, and he went down to Texas to sort of rectify the situation, took a gun with him and another friend, and they got into an altercation with the vet, and the gun went off, and they shot the vet and killed him. And, of course, when they got picked up by the police, they said Ray had sent them to do the dirty work, which he hadn't, and he was arrested along with the two hustlers. And it was a very sad story.
Wow. Now, again, the book's subtitle is The Parallel Lives of Mae West and Ray Bourbon. So let's talk about those parallel lives. They had at some points worked together, but they also had separate careers, as you say, that were parallel.
Yes, long careers. They were born within a year of each other. Mae West in Bushwick, New York, which is Brooklyn, and Ray was born in a little border town in Texas. He has kind of a cloudy history, pedigree. Anyway, his mother was unwed and came from a convent in France where she'd been living, and was sent to Texas by one of the nuns who had relatives there so that she could give the child birth in secret, and they were going to hire her as a housekeeper and let her live in the house and let Ray stay there. And unfortunately, she died in childbirth, and the people were very kind, and they adopted Ray. And so as a little boy, he grew up in this little tiny border town in Texas, which apparently Ray was very effeminate and very out from a very early age. And his one parent, his father, his stepfather actually, didn't accept it and sent him to London, which was fortuitous because the man knew a private school for troubled boys, and Ray went to school there. And while he was in school there, he was taken under the wing of one of the professors who was interested in theater and took Ray to music halls as a very young lad. And Ray saw for the first time a female impersonator, or as the English call them, a dame. Well, he decided then and there he wanted to be a female impersonator. Long story short, he ends up getting to be one on the London stages, and then goes to New York to try his hand in vaudeville. That's where he met Mae West. She'd also been in vaudeville, struggling, wasn't really making it, and decided to write some plays that she could star in. In one play she wrote, although she wasn't a star in it, was called The Drag. And she went to the local gay night spots to audition different drag queens, and Ray happened to be one of 40 that were in the cast. So that was the beginning of Ray's association with Mae. This was in 1927 in the play called The Drag. And by the way, it was rated, and they all went to jail.
And we're talking about a time, I think people should be aware of the fact that when it comes to gays, homosexuality was still illegal back then.
It was illegal, but Ray lived in New York, and it was a sort of that look sideways sort of thing with the law. They, unless you really were doing something, you know, in a public place, they pretty much let them get away with it. And in fact, female impersonation was very accepted in vaudeville. It was a staple. There was many impersonator vaudevillians, as there were singers, dancers, jugglers, and, you know, trained seal acts.
When you started putting this book together, who did you see as your audience? Who were you writing it for the most?
Well, I'll tell you, initially, I had done a rough draft mostly about Ray. And I contacted several publishers, and one in particular, Bear Manor Media, was very interested, but they wisely guided me to expand my audience and to give an equal part to his association with Mae West, because Mae West is, you know, it's a household word like Coca-Cola. And they were correct in doing that, because I've gotten some really wonderful acceptance on the book from all sorts of people, gay and straight.
Does Ray Bourbon have any relatives that are still living, nieces, nephews, cousins, things like that?
No, nothing. You know, he was adopted, number one, by a family called the Waddells, and they are long gone, and they had no other children. And Ray was very given to exaggeration. He took the name Bourbon instead of Waddell, and he liked to claim that he's descended from the Bourbon Kings of France, which I think probably there's no veracity to.
So, having had the chance to hear his stories, having had the chance to meet him, what do you think his feelings would be that you've written this book about him?
Well, I hope he would appreciate it. It, of course, is very hard to say. There's been lots of articles written about Ray, lots of magazine, newspaper articles, blogs, people talking about it. By the way, he was one of the first gay recording stars. He produced 11 LPs, and before that, in the 78 era, he recorded all during the 30s and 40s. And those recordings are still available, for instance, on eBay. And it gives you a wonderful idea of his voice and his style.
It's an interesting story indeed. The book is called Double Entendre, The Parallel Lives of Mae West and Ray Bourbon. It's written by Patrick Byrne. And Patrick, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program and sharing this story.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure.
Patrick C. Byrne, author of Double Entendre, The Parallel Lives of Mae West and Ray Bourbon. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0444, and you'll find links to the page of his publisher's website, which is Bear Manor Media. You'll also find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Identity theft is a serious problem these days, but it's also a big business. When companies experience security breaches that allow the personal information of their clients to get into the hands of criminals, it can generate millions of dollars for those hired to clean up the mess. The challenge in these cases is making sure that the number one priority is protecting the clients from fraud. That's why you should know what recently happened in a class action lawsuit against insurance company Anthem after a security breach there. Plaintiff lawyers who sued the company negotiated a settlement of $115 million, but they asked the judge to pay $63 million of that to themselves. Let's be fair, that means that the lawyers would have received more than half of the money from the lawsuit. Outrageous. To protect Anthem's clients from being robbed of the money they deserve, the judge overseeing the case has taken the rare step of appointing a special master to now investigate the lawyers. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, our favorite cab driver from New York City, the city that never sleeps, is with us once again. And Mr. Franklin, I'm concerned for your well-being. I've been reading stories about what's going on in New York with cab drivers. How is your mental health?
Well, my mental health is fine, but I'm upset like a lot of other cab drivers are upset. And let me explain to you nice listening and listeners what's going on. New York City, the yellow cabs, we've had, I'd say about 13,000 of them since 1938. I mean, that's a pretty long time. And the reason they kind of had a cap on the cabs is they just didn't want to have too many cabs on the streets of New York. It was enough to service the public. And also it made it possible for the average cab driver to make a fair living. Well, Uber and these other brand name kind of taxi things have come along, and they've added another 30 to 35,000 cabs to New York City. So it's become a pretty tough market. Even there, they're not making the money either. There's just too many cabs, too many cab drivers. And now they're talking about having a congestion tax where it would cost you money if you drive into Manhattan. That's not going to help the situation. The situation is now, what are you going to do with all these taxis? Now, within the last month, two cab drivers have committed suicide because of financial problems. And our dopey mayor made the comment that, well, they were probably emotionally upset, which I don't think answers the question at all. So that's a tragedy in itself. So there we are. We got a mess. Too many cars, too many cabs, too many drivers on the streets of New York. Boy, if any of your nice listeners are thinking of driving into New York, don't.
Now, I don't want to ask any personal questions about finances and the amount of money you make. I'm a polite Canadian. We don't ask those kinds of questions. But I will ask you this question. Are you making the same amount of money or more than you were, say, 20 years ago?
No, much less.
Much less.
Remember, one of the things that I do is I give people tours of New York City. Now, that's kind of like a specialized thing. When I'm driving a yellow taxi, it's pick somebody up, drop somebody off, pick somebody up, drop somebody off. When I'm giving them a tour, that's an all-day thing, which brings me more money. So that's one of the reasons why I'm almost not starving to death like all the other cab drivers, because the tour is more than supplemental. And I didn't mean to make that sound like some kind of an advertisement on your show, but that's what I do. I give tours of New York.
And by the way, people can find out more information about those tours by going to your website and sending you an email to peter@gabby.com. You don't want to plug it, but I'm more than happy to, sir. So there you go.
Well, bless you. Bless you, my son.
Now, there are several tunnels around New York City. You have your Lincoln Tunnel, you have your Holland Tunnel. Are you worried that El Chapo might be building another one?
Oh, I hope he is, because as a matter of fact, one of the tours that I give is I give people tours of Brooklyn, and he happens to be in the Brooklyn Federal Prison. So what I do when I drive by is I say, that's where the tunnel is going to start, and that's where the tunnel is going to end. But the side story to that, Peter, is that the judge has asked or said to this guy, will you promise not to kill the jurors? Which is, you know, a really strange thing, but he did. And El Chapo said, of course not. I won't have any of the jurors killed. How's that for something that's creepy?
How do you get someone who is willing to be on that particular jury? I understand that the parties involved in the jury, they're all being sequestered. They're being driven to and from the courthouse. Their names aren't being given up. They're literally prisoners themselves.
Yeah, well, you know, but you don't have a choice. It's not an optional thing. I've never served on a federal jury. I've served on a city and a state jury. You're not given a choice. You're called for jury duty, and you got to come up with a pretty good reason for the judge to let you off the hook. So it's not optional. And you just can't say you're scared, you know, or you just don't like the guy, or you can't give a fair verdict or something like that. You got to come up with a very good reason. The only reason and I'm not really 100% sure, and it certainly doesn't apply to me, is that I don't think you can be over 65 or 70. I think then you can say that you don't want to do it. I'm not sure that.
You can get out of jury duty if you're a journalist or broadcaster, by the way.
Yeah, well, because, you know, they always lie.
So there is...
Except you.
There is a way out. There is
what
a way
is the
out.
Way out?
Well, like I said, if you're here in Canada, like I said, if you're a journalist, which I believe is the same in the United States, if you're a teacher, and also if you're a teacher of, special needs students, for some odd reason, you can just say that's what you are, assuming that that is what you are, and you're automatically excused.
Well, I mean, I can see that. I mean, it's a very particular occupation. But generally speaking, jury duty is not easy to get out of. And you're, as a matter of fact, when they start sending you notices to report, if you don't report, they give you an indication that you can be arrested for not reporting.
Absolutely. Meanwhile, one of the other stories in the news has to do with the homeless in New York. And I understand some of them are being put up in some pretty fancy digs.
Well, New York City goes out of its way to try to have a place for every homeless person, but we don't have enough homeless shelters. So what they do is they put them into regular hotels. And that's presenting an interesting situation because you're a person who's spending $400 a night at a hotel, and in the next room you have people who are getting it for nothing. Not that they're bad people specifically. I mean, they're having troubles in life and all that. So what's happening is the hotels are going out of their way to try to get the homeless people because it's good business for them, and the city pays for their rooms, which means, strangely enough, and this is a little travel advisory, it's now becoming possible to bargain with hotels. In other words, if you're booking a room or a suite at a small hotel and they tell you it's going to be $350 or $400 a night, it's worth giving it a shot and saying, how about $280 or $290? Because you just might pull it off, because ultimately they would rather have the paying guest than the homeless guest, but they're not going to let the room go empty.
Mm. So you're not going to ask the question, how much for the homeless? That isn't a bargaining point right there?
Well, I don't know that you know, it depends on how you handle it, but they figure that the homeless is not going to be having room service and laundry and all those other things. Because remember, a lot of the money that the hotels get doesn't come just from the room. All the homeless are getting is the room. And it's really a nasty word because people are down on their luck. And, I mean, as long as it's legitimate, I have no particular problem with somebody being helped. Mm-hmm. There, but for the grace of God, go thee.
Meanwhile, we are still here in the depths of winter. The groundhog did not see its shadow, so we know that what that means. But having said that, even though it's winter, I want to talk a little bit about ice cream. I understand there's a business in Chinatown that is beloved for its ice cream, and it could be going out of business?
Yeah, well, it's the Chinese Ice Cream Factory. It's a very nice place, but it's kind of brought to the front of our latest debate here, is that New York City has laws which kind of cover residential apartments, rent-stabilized and not really rent-controlled, but a landlord can't just charge anything he wants for an apartment, especially on a renewal. But if it's a commercial lease, they can charge anything they want when it comes to the renewal time. And if the business is making money, landlord's going to really sock it to them. So here's this ice cream factory place. It's not a factory. It's really a retail store that is going to probably go out of business because their rent has been increased so much they can't afford to do it. And that's going to change the quality of the stores in New York if all the little stores start getting put out of business because they can't handle the rent.
Mm. Oh, not good news. You scream ice cream, we all scream for ice cream. Before we let you go, sir.
And Tyler too.
Before we let you go, sir, I want to ask you about your celebrity sighting. I understand you saw somebody walking along a certain street and... I'm surprised he didn't trip, because he used to fall a lot.
Yeah, well, he didn't. I'm talking about Chevy Chase, and I saw him at an interesting place. The Metropolitan Museum of Art is currently having a Michelangelo exhibit, and we went over there, I and She Who Must Be Obeyed, and he was there. And normally, when I see a celebrity, most people don't even realize it. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm more alert to it. But it never ceases to amaze me how people just walk by celebrities. Everybody noticed him. There was no question about it. And by the way, he isn't in real life like he is in the movies. He wasn't falling over or acting silly. He seemed quite pleasant and quite nice.
Glad to hear it. And always glad to talk to you, sir. As I mentioned earlier, people can find out more information about those tours that you offer by going to your website, which is Gabby.com, or sending you an email to peter@gabby.com. Thank you very much, sir, for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you for that, Peter. Everybody have a wonderful. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have another Stuff File news story that I want to share with you before we end off things. And of course, there's an idiot of the day coming your way, so stick around for that. You know, a little while ago, we talked to an author from the Bear Manor Media Publishing House, Patrick C. Byrne, who has the book Double Entendre. As I mentioned, his book is published by Bear Manor Media. He's not the only author whose book is published by Bear Manor Media, you know. There are hundreds of books by Bear Manor Media. Heck, my book is published by Bear Manor Media. You know, the one I've mentioned every show since its release. But in case you missed it, the book is called Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. And like the title says, within the pages, you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. So order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher. And if you've been paying attention, folks, you know that's Bear Manor Media. So you can find it at BearManorMedia.com as well. All the links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So buy the book. What are you waiting for? Buy it now. Go ahead. I'll wait. Okay. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? 29-year-old Aaron Meininger of Hernando Beach, Florida, was arrested on February 2nd after Hernando County deputies caught him stealing items from the DeMarco family funeral home in Spring Hill. When officers arrived, Aaron was carrying a tub of formaldehyde out of the building. They also found makeup, nail polish, electric clippers, soap, and other items used in funeral preparation in Aaron's car. Curiously, the Tampa Bay Times reported that Aaron told deputies that he was bored and messed up and didn't even know what kind of business he was burgling. He said he probably would have just thrown the stolen items away. You know, most funeral homes have some kind of sign saying what their business is. Plus, the thermostats are usually a few degrees cooler than other businesses. Also, the word formaldehyde should have been, you know, some kind of a hint. Unless, of course, poor Aaron couldn't read the word formaldehyde. Yes, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, is he? Not quite the idiot of the day, though. No, 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 no. I could have made him the idiot of the day, I suppose, but I chose not to. But now, boys and girls, this is the moment you've all been waiting for, because right now, it's time for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
In the over two decades that I've done this segment, rarely do I collectively include a group of people. In fact, I've only done that once. But this week, I'm compelled to point out one idiot and anyone who follows him. It was bad enough in 2017 when someone came along on YouTube with the Tide Pod Challenge. YouTube is fast becoming the one-stop site for people who miss the television show Jackass. But now there's something even more ignorant and hard to understand why someone would want to emulate it. It's called the Hot Coil Challenge. It involves heating the hob of an electric stove, then exposing one's bare skin to the red-hot metal heating coils. A video depicting the challenge was released this month, showing a participant suffering from third-degree burns as a result of holding his arm down on the burning metal. Now, as dumb as the Tide Pod Challenge or the Cinnamon Swallow Challenge are, they were just escalations from such time-honored idiocy as being dared as kids to stick your tongue to a pole in the winter. But when it comes to hot stoves, or irons for that matter, usually we learn our lessons as toddlers by accident when we touch something hot, or we have had our hands slapped away by angry and terrified parents when we attempt to touch something hot. Either way, we quickly understand and learn our lesson. So, why, oh why, would anyone knowingly place their forearm on a hot stove? And why, oh why, would someone think that this is a challenge they need to accept and take on? One reason, and one reason only. They're all idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0444. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0444. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.